QMWA Dick, are you out there tonight?
Yes, I am. I'm waiting for the machine to say that it's in the net mode, which it hasn't done yet. Okay, Bob. At this time, you begin the tick net on Landmark. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and along with Mel, K2KEY, we intend to hold our little miniature class, our mini class, on ham radio. Bob is our first one to sign in. MWA, and I presume you will have a question for us. Is that true, Bob?
No, I don't, but I'm going to be listening.
Okay. Just waiting you hear all the stuff we're going to be talking about. You'll come up with a question. So the way a person signs in to the TechNet is to give Mel and me your call letters, your name, and confirming yes, and the yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So, for people who want to check in, give me your call letters and name right now.
This is W2PNJ. The answer is yes. This is Bob. Good evening, guys.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John, yes.
K2KY, good evening, all.
Okay, we've got Bob number 1, Bob number 2, John, and Mel. Anyone else?
Gordon W2TTT, no.
WB2CUK, Bill, just absorbing.
Forwarded to backslash HP1GP, Gilberto.
Okay, we've also got Bill and another person whose call letters I didn't recognize. HG1KB or something like that.
Okay, good evening, everyone. This is W2 backslash Hotel Papa 1, Golf Alpha Papa. My name is Gilberto. Good evening.
Okay, Hotel Papa Golf, Hotel Papa 1, I think it is. Golf Alpha Papa. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters at this time. Okay, let's start off with Bob number 1, W2PNJ. What would you like to ask us tonight, Bob?
I presently have a 10 to 20 meter beam, and on it has the 12 meter, 17 meter, those fans that are in between, they call them the WARC. I'd like to know what that means. And my big question is, though, the antenna I have now, for example, at 17 meters, has 0 dB gain and 0 dB front to back. What would I gain as far as S units, if you can tell me that, if I put up an antenna that had, on the same band, let's say 17 meters, a gain of 6.7 dB, and 12 dB front-to-back ratio. So from zero front-to-back and zero gain up to one that has a 6.7 dB gain and a 12 dB front-to-back ratio. That's it.
Okay. I was waiting for the beam, but there isn't one. I'm slowly getting used to the new system here. A well-calibrated S-meter, Bob, is supposed to have 6 decibels per S-unit. That's the definition. On top of that, an S9 is supposed to be a 50 microvolt signal. Another definition. You go out and measure the signal strength meter, the S meter, on most of the popular rigs, you're going to find they differ from that by quite a bit. Some of them are very scotch. Some of them are very liberal. In other words, they read very high. Manufacturers realize that if a guy had a very scotch meter and he hands out a whole lot of S3 reports when everyone's handing out signal reports of 10 over S9, the person with those weak signal reports is not going to be a popular fellow. So I think many manufacturers make sure that their S meter reads high. There are various ways you can connect a signal generator, a calibrated signal generator, to your piece of equipment. And you can either make yourself a real calibration chart, or in a few cases, you can twist the knobs inside if they give you enough internal potentiometers by which you can readjust the offset and gain and make it come closer. The closest rig I ever saw was my Drake R4C receiver, which had something very close to 5 decibels per S unit instead of 6. So if you started off with an antenna that is 0 dB gain over whatever the reference is, and that represents a little bit of a problem because some manufacturers use decibels over isotropic, others use decibels over dipole. A dipole has, again by definition, at least by John Krause's definition, 2.14 decibels over isotropic. That's what a dipole's got. Lots of manufacturers will not tell you what the gain is with reference to. They just say the gain is X number of dB. And in many cases, they're using decibels over isotropic because it makes the numbers 2.14 dB higher. But assuming now that your antenna really was zero in decibels, by the way, is not zero gain. It's just zero with reference to your standard, whatever that is. And if your antenna has 6.7 dB more than that, the new antenna, since it's supposed to be 6 decibels per S unit, that would be a little bit more than 1 S unit. 6 dB would be 1 S unit, and 7 tenths is going to be approximately another tenth. So 1.1 S units increase on the new antenna. When it comes to front-to-back ratio almost doesn't matter when it comes to an S meter reading if the antenna is aimed at the guy you care about. Where front-to-back ratio comes in is that it's one of the mechanisms that helps the gain. In other words, an antenna with 0 dB front-to-back ratio usually has sacrificed some of the potential forward gain of that antenna. A great big long string, a horizontal string of collinear dipoles would have 0 dB front-to-back ratio, but if you put 8 dipoles together, you would have something like, 4 dipoles together, you would have something like 6 dB of gain over a single dipole. Every time you double the number of antennas with proper spacing, you get 3 dB of increase. So the first double is from 1 to 2, that's a 3 dB increase. The next double is from 2 to 4, another 3 dB increase. And if you want to really go hog wild, 4 to 8 would be another 3. You could have 9 dB of gain over dipole if you strung out 8 dipoles horizontally. There'd be a big structure on both of these bands, but it's possible. But that's an example of an antenna with no front-to-back ratio. And front-to-back ratio, the main reason you want it there is so that you can get that extra gain forward, because gain of an antenna is not gain like you've got with an amplifier. An amplifier, you really supply B-plus voltage to it. You give it the ability to come out with a stronger signal on the output than you put on the input. That's what you do with your brick amplifier. But in the case of an antenna, it doesn't have a B-plus connection. It doesn't really have gain. It's just that it squirts all the signal like a flashlight beam in one direction, and it does it better than a bare light bulb, so to speak. That's an isotropic. And so a flashlight with a reflector in the light bulb tends to squirt all the signal in one direction, and a flashlight could easily have 20 decibels of gain. And so you can sort of see now, by way of the referencing system, the definition of gain is quite different with an antenna. WARC, W-A-R-C, I think stood for World Administrative Radio Council. Once every 3, 4, 5 years, I forget what the number is, all the major radio users, the wireless countries in the world, get together, have a conference, and they decide what frequencies will be allocated to satellites, what frequencies will be allocated to broadcast, what frequencies will be allocated to fire and police, and so on. What frequencies will be settled will be allocated to ham radio. In general, those individual countries agree on this, particularly if they're adjacent countries. But when it comes to what ham radio frequencies are allowed in Australia versus what ham radio frequencies are allowed in the United States, which are essentially 12,000 miles apart, those allocations can differ. But so these new frequencies, 12 and 17 meters and so on, were a kind of a work agreement between most of the nations, and those agreements took place at a particular year, and beyond that year, within those restrictions, you're allowed to use those frequencies. There's even now a frequency you're allowed to use that's close to 5 megacycles, which is quite unusual. I guess that would be the 60-meter ham band, if I got that right. Yeah, I think it's a 60-meter ham band. answer some of your questions, Bob. W2PNJ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. No, it does. So we're talking about, and essentially, a little, a schmutz more of one S unit to get that. The specs are in dBd, decibel with a D. That's dBd. So maybe that's decibels over dipole. That's what I'm going to assume. But you answered my question. Thank you, my friend. I'll be on the side listening.
Yeah, that is the universal standard. dBd, by gentleman's agreement, stands for dB with reference to dipole, and dB slash I or dBi means decibels with reference to isotropic. Dipole is a nice reference in that it's easily reproduced antenna. That's the good news. The bad news is an isotropic antenna, or a dipole, squirt signal everywhere in the world, so when you actually use it on an antenna range, it's a very difficult antenna to use. Your multiple reflections in the forward and the reverse direction tend to make the readings a little more ambiguous. Particularly on VHF frequencies, a good antenna range will use some kind of a standard like the EIA standard, which is a pair of dipoles over a ground plane, or a standard gain horn, but something with higher gain. Or everyone agrees on a particular Yagi antenna and they all make comparisons with it. The reason why you'd like to have a high gain reference antenna is because it favors one particular direction, eliminates a lot of the extraneous reflections on the antenna range, and in general you get the more accurate readings, more reproducible readings when you use a higher gain antenna than a dipole. But since the reference itself has some amount of stated gain with reference to isotropic or reference to dipole, you then add the numbers together. In other words, if you were using at, let's say at 1296, you were using a standard gain horn, and some standard gain horns had 16 decibel of gain over ISO. And if your particular antenna measured 2 dB better than that standard gain horn, your 1296 dish measured 2 dB better than the standard gain horn, which is known to be 16, 16 plus 2 is 18, that would suggest that your antenna is 18 over isotropic, if the horn is with reference to isotropic. You can see how the comparison technique is one of the best techniques for really measuring antenna gain. The second best technique is to measure the pattern. But here you got to be careful. There are lots of guys that will measure the 3 dB beam width of an antenna, plug it into a formula, and they think that means the proper amount of gain. Well, it turns out an antenna with a known amount of gain will have a certain 3 dB beam width. Unfortunately, that's a necessary but not sufficient condition. You can easily make an antenna that has less gain than that, but has the right beam width of the main lobe. But it may have a bunch of lobes all over the place in other areas. So, as I said, it's necessary but not sufficient. To really convert pattern into gain by way of a formula, you have to sweep the antenna in azimuth and measure the pattern. You have to sweep the antenna in elevation, measure the pattern. And if you want to be super thorough, measure the antenna by sweeping it at a 45 degree angle, midway between horizontal and vertical. Put all that data together into a real good computer program, and yes, you do now know the gain with extremely high accuracy. Very few people have the resources to do all that, both as far as making all those measurements in a reproducible manner, and also the right kind of a computer program to crunch all of that data. But that's what's really required, because there's always the possibility your antenna has got a great big lobe somewhere in elevation that you don't see when you're sweeping it only in the azimuth, and therefore you could easily come up with an optimistic number. Alrighty, the next person was Bob, K2MWA, who says he has no question right now. John, KD2 Bravo Delta, I think it is. Go right ahead, John. K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick, K2RIW on the TechNet from KD2BD. My comment has something to do with the discussion from last week. that was a carryover from the week before regarding calculating path loss over unobstructed paths. I think it was K2JJ who had a question. He posed a scenario where you have a transmitter and receiver over level ground a certain distance away from one another, and you calculate or you measure the received signal strength from that transmitter. And then, I believe he said, if you take either the receiver or the transmitter or both, I'm not sure, one or both, and put them on a 50-foot tower the same distance away over the same terrain, and you measure the signal strength, will the signal strength be the same as it is over just above ground level? And I know you were saying things regarding slant range, and you said that the signal strength would be about the same if we disregard ground reflection. Well, I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, and it's something that amateurs don't talk about very much. I believe that if the scenario where you have two towers, and in that condition, the signal strength would be greater than it would be over ground level, even if there's a line-of-sight path in both situations. And the reason why is because of the Fresnel zone that exists between the transmitter and receiver in that situation. The Fresnel zone is a volume of space that's kind of shaped an elliptical pattern, kind of looks like a Goodyear blimp between the transmitter and receiver, and it's very fat in the middle of the path, and it narrows down at the end points. Well, that entire volume of space needs to be free of obstructions in order for that equation to work out accurately. And if you're close to the ground, the bottom end of that Fresnel zone is going to be blocked, so I don't believe you're going to get the full signal strength that calculation predicts. Now, the Fresnel zone is actually kind of complex. You have a first Fresnel zone, and in that volume of space, all the radiated energy that is received is in phase. So it arrives in phase and it adds together. And there's a region beyond that called the second Fresnel zone where the radiated energy that's received is out of phase. So in that range, a little blockage might actually work out well for you. There are some people who deal with digital wireless networks, and they get very concerned with Fresnel zone because they're working with very low power and they're very concerned about their bit error rates and things like that. Sometimes they consider 60% clearage of the first Fresnel zone to be okay. Some aim for a scenario where they have 80% clearance of the first Fresnel zone. So again, in that scenario, because of that, I believe even if terrain isn't a problem, height is still might, and if you can clear the first Fresnel zone by getting some altitude on both ends, I think that equation will work out more accurately, and you will get a stronger signal than you would get at ground level. K2RAW on the TechNet from KD2BD.
Very fine, John. You brought forth some very interesting information. You got to be careful how you use that information, though. Everything you've said is 100% accurate, but there's a catch. And the example I use in this situation is a little bit exaggerated, but it gets the point across. If you were camping out in the woods and you suddenly encounter a grizzly bear, you don't have to know is he 400 pounds or 600 pounds. His exact weight doesn't matter. The fact that he's a grizzly bear, he's a carnivore, and as far as he's concerned, you're a chunk of food that's got some cloth on the outside of it, and all he's got to do is peel away the cloth and he can get to the food. So he's a predator, you're the victim, and you better be moving pretty fast in the other direction or heading for some form of protection. His exact weight doesn't matter. Similarly with the Fresnel zones, there's the odd and even Fresnel zones, which means that when a particular piece of material, tree, water tower, ground, or whatever, penetrates one of the odd or even Fresnel zones, the signal reflected from the ground going from antenna 1 to antenna number 2 is either in phase or out of phase. However, in many circumstances, that's a second order effect. That's like asking whether or not the grizzly bear is 400 pounds or 600 pounds, so to speak. Without a doubt, you're right. When you're setting up a marginal communication system between two antennas in an urban environment, we'll say, where you've got a whole lot of jazz out there, whole bunch of trees, buildings, water towers, and each one of them all adds a little bit of signal. The signal going from antenna A to antenna B does have one new used in my example, in a vector manner, which means every one of those signals, when it arrives at the receiving antenna, has a particular amplitude and a particular phase angle. And in polar space, so to speak, Mother Nature adds all of those voltages, all of those amplitudes and all those phase angles, and comes up with a composite. So when you're sure you don't have enough phase margin, you don't have enough transmit power, enough antenna gain on transmit and receive, enough receiver sensitivity, to be sure you've got a whole lot of extra margin in the system. When you've got a system like that, calculating the Fresnel zones and trying to lay things out to make them most favorable for those Fresnel zones is a good thing to do. Those Fresnel zones are telling you something about, will the signals reflected off the extraneous objects in the volume of space between the two antennas, will all those signals come out favorable or unfavorable in amplitude? There's another big catch, and that is inter-symbol distortion. All of those extraneous paths have a longer path to go through. Therefore, they become delayed in time. If your data rate is fast enough, some of the ones and zeros overlap each other between the various signals, and you get all kinds of corruption of the signal, and the poor receiver may not be able to figure it all out. Now, when you set up an antenna range, in the old days, they used to try to use two high towers so far up that everything's outside of the Fresnel zone. Sounds good, but there's a problem. And that is, if the antennas you're testing are broad enough in beamwidth, you still have that main ground reflection. As far as the ground reflection is concerned, if you're looking at the whole system from the point of view of the receiving antenna, that receiving antenna sees the real antenna above the ground, sees the mirror image of that antenna below ground, and adds the two together. And if it's a horizontally polarized signal, the reflection off the ground, which is the most major reflection in most cases, becomes 180-degree phase shifted. As such, most of the outdoor antenna ranges today, when they're following the IEEE preferred antenna testing procedure, will put the source antenna very low to the ground, so that the source antenna is way inside all of those Fresnel zones. At first it seems opposite of common sense, but if you set it up just right, you make the source antenna and the reflection of it below the ground look so close together, because they really are close to the ground and because you're so far away. Second of all, if your antenna under test is at the right angle in elevation, even though there's 180 degrees of phase shift and an extra path length for the ground reflected signal, at the right altitude, those two things come back out in phase. So therefore, you get a scalloped pattern in elevation of signal strength versus altitude. And you usually choose the very first peak of that scallop pattern, which might be, oh, we'll say 15 feet off the ground, and if it's got plus or minus 5 feet where it's only 1 dB, 5 feet of elevation, where there's only 1 dB of change in amplitude, you then have a very nice, what they call, quiet zone, where you can put an antenna that's smaller than that dimension into that quiet zone and make a measurement that is very traceable to the Bureau. So therefore, a smart guy will realize that every realistic outdoor antenna range is going to have ground reflection. Therefore, if you're smart enough, you use that ground reflection in your favor. Instead of fighting it, you'll use it. You'll go with the flow. And so a smart guy with the right kind of what's called a reflective ground plane antenna range can make some extremely good measurements, particularly if it's a so-called interferometry range or I can't even think of the name of the darn machine now that's used for that. And I wrote an article on this, too, in February 1976 QST. It'll come to me in a minute. It's a comparison technique, a comparator. In other words, you have a real antenna and a reference antenna side by side, both looking at the source antenna that's close to the ground. Properly done, that comparison antenna range can make measurements that are accurate to a couple of tenths of a dB. So using the ground reflection in your favor is a very favorable thing to do. Now, how we got all into this 2 or 3 weeks ago is the fact that for years and years and years, you, John, I, and everybody else has been hearing terrible disparaging remarks about rubber duck antennas. We think the rubber duck antenna that sits on top of our handy-talkie is the worst thing that was ever invented by mankind, second only to UHF connectors, which people also develop a very strong dislike for. Turns out that rubber duck antenna, of modern design, is an extremely good antenna. It runs at 98% efficiency, and I'm not kidding. Yes, in the old days, they used to be made out of nichrome wire. They were intentionally made resistive to give a good standing wave ratio reading, and the fact that the antenna was inefficient did exist. Amateurs started making measurements, confirmed that problem, took the things apart, saw the nichrome inside, starting voting with their pocketbook, started complaining, and nowadays, almost every rubber duck antenna you buy, inside of that rubber, you'll find a piece of spring steel with copper coating on the outside. It really is a copper-clad antenna, and every watt you put into it, 0.99 watts, is radiated into space. So the question I asked at that time, which has really been a mind-blower for a lot of people, Mel and I have gotten a lot of email on this one, at least I have. It's on the subject of what is the range of a handy-talkie? If I had a single old-fashioned 1985 ICOM IC2AT handy-talkie, 3 watts, 4 watts output, rubber duck antenna in my hand, and I hand one to my son and he goes walking down the street, and if you ask the average amateur in the New York City area, how far will he get? And the answer is about a mile, mile and a half before he gets unreliable communication. I started asking that question to the guys in Dallas, Texas. Because they don't have as many trees there and they've got flatter land, their answer is 2.5 miles. As far as they're concerned, handy-talkie to handy-talkie, about 2.5 on a good day, 3 miles, and that's it. And therefore, I started asking the question, if one of the antennas is up very high and the other guy's antenna is standing on the ground with a thing in his hand, what kind of range can you get? And we got answers like 10, 20, 30 miles. The real answer is 3,100 miles. Of course that sounds crazy. I've done it. I listened to astronaut Owen Garriott on space shuttle number 9, I think it was, 1985. He was running a Motorola handy-talkie with a tape dipole on the observation window of the crew quarters of the space shuttle. And he was over North Texas, about a mile from space. I stood in the parking lot near Park, Long Island, at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, with my handy-talkie in hand, and I heard the signal coming from him, not quite dead full quieting, but damn close. Plenty of signal at 1,500 miles. I then squeezed the trigger and talked back to him, and I was wasting my time. No way in hell did he hear me, because there's 1,000 guys shouting at him at once, and I was a peanut whistle. I finally did talk to him by at home aiming a 14-element Yagi down his throat, carefully adjusted with 300 watts of power. And when I bought that tape recording and I listened to my voice as recorded on the space shuttle, I was just barely above the noise, running 5,000 watts of effective radiated power, because I had to climb above that rabble, so to speak. But the real communication, at least in one direction, the rubber duck can do it. The handy-talkie, with a quarter microvolt or half a microvolt of sensitivity, has got a certain number of negative dBm. The transmit power of 1 watt would be plus 30, 5 watts or 4 watts would be plus 36. You add it all together, that handy-talkie, if it's working well, has a power spread of 150 decibels. That's the difference between the transmit power and the minimum signal it can receive. It can overcome 150 decibels. That's a range of 3,100 miles. Therefore, when you walk down the street with that handy-talkie in your hand, and you get 1.5 miles, 2 miles with it, and you calculate what happens for the first miles, which is 70 or 80 dB, and you'll find out that the terrain is giving you an extra 70 decibels of loss. Let me repeat that. The terrain. In other words, when that guy walks 1.5 or 2 miles away, with your binoculars, you try to track him, and pretty soon he's behind trees, behind buildings, behind water towers, behind earth curvature, hills, whatever. All of that stuff in the terrain is giving you an extra 70 decibels of loss. It ain't the rubber duck that's causing the problem. The rubber duck is very close to 0 dB over isotropic, running at nearly 100% efficiency. Everybody blames the rubber duck. It's the terrain. You've raised the antenna so that you now clear the terrain and you've got line of sight between the two, except for a little bit of multipath effects that you and I have just been talking about. The signal will get 70 decibels stronger. It's time we stop blaming the rubber duck. I wouldn't care if you used a 5/8 wave whip connected to that handy talkie that picks you up another couple of dB. Big deal. The terrain is giving you 70 dB. Yes, that's why we VHF people all wish we had 100 feet of tower. We all wished we lived 200 feet above sea level somewhere on Long Island or the metropolitan area to clear the terrain. Every bit of altitude helps. Some people found the numbers for this kind of amazing. But when in doubt, you can always calculate exactly what free space loss is. And at that formula, I'm going to repeat right now. Write this one down. Free space loss in decibels is equal to a constant number, 36.6, plus 20 times the log of F, plus 20 times the log of D. D is miles, statute miles. F is frequency in megahertz. So when in doubt, in that formula, you can plug in small fractions of a mile and calculate what the insertion loss is for 1 foot if you want to. It works. 36.6 plus 20 times log of F plus 20 times log of D. That is free space. Once you know that your handy talkie is going to overcome 145 to 150 dB of power spread between transmitter and receiver sensitivity, and you plug in 146.85 megacycles, and you plug in whatever mileage you want to so that it all adds up to 145 or 150 dB, and you'll be into the 2,000 mile category. It ain't the rubber duck. That's the main point I was making. A handy talkie held in your hand, fed with that rubber duck, is a darn good emitter. And until you connect something to it like a four-element Yagi antenna on top of the chimney of your house, until you've done that, you haven't done very much to improve that darn good system that we've all been saying disparaging remarks about all of these years. That's the main point I was making. Back to you, John. I know you're going to have some comments on all of this. KD2BD, sorry to be so long-winded. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hi, David. K2RIW on the TechNet from KD2BD. I just happen to have the February 1976 issue of QST, and you're talking about UHF antenna ratiometry. Where to start? Well, actually, I'm in the process. I've authored some software that actually calculates, or at least attempts to come somewhat close to what actual path loss over real ground conditions comes out to be using topography data. In the past, I've used topography data from issued by the U.S. Geological Survey. More recently, I'm using data that's come off the STS-99 shuttle radar mapping mission. And I'm using the Longley-Rice propagation model to actually calculate what path loss is between point to point based on losses of terrain. I'm working on the next version of the program. The next version of the program is a little bit more involved in that I'm taking into account antenna pattern information. In particular, I've been working with the Vice President of Engineering of the Telemundo television network. Happens to be a ham. He provided me with some information of an auxiliary television transmitter on Mount Wilson, California. He provided me with all the antenna pattern data and on that antenna, and it's really quite odd. It's a UHF antenna. It has a very narrow vertical beam width. It has electrical beam tilt, and it has mechanical beam tilt, and has multiple pattern rotation all mixed into the equation. And the real challenging part in trying to calculate the received signal or the path loss from point A to point B in a situation like that is it's all pretty easy when there's no obstruction in the path, but when there is an obstruction in the path, I have to calculate the antenna pattern effect, or what the gain of the antenna pattern is in that particular direction, up to the point of the first obstruction. Because the Longley-Rice model considers all energy reaching a distant point that's in an obstructed area as being the energy scattered from the top of the first obstruction. So I have to mathematically figure out where the first obstruction is, figure out what the elevation angle to that point is from the transmitter site, and then base the radiated energy or the total path loss from that point of elevation based on the elevation pattern of the antenna, and then add in the Longley-Rice model loss to that to find out what the final loss is. Interesting, I also something I've also talked about on TechNet in the past, the Mars and Moon scenarios for exploration. Well, in early October, I received a note from a gentleman at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory who's actually working on that sort of thing. He told me that he had downloaded my software and was working to adapt it to work in Martian and lunar exploration scenarios. And I think just last week I think NASA or JPL actually announced that, yes, they are working on bases and things like that in the future. So it's going to happen. Incidentally, I got to see the shuttle launch off the coast of New Jersey the other night, and looking forward to having some visible passes in the night sky later this week, I believe, starting on Friday. K2REW on a TechNet from KD2BD.
You and I get a second comment, John. I watched the shuttle fly by my house. I went to the nearest schoolyard in Huntington, which has got a great big athletic field, and the nearest trees, a thin line of trees on slightly lower land, with 300 yards away. So therefore I had about a 4-degree takeoff angle before I'm blocked to the horizon. And with a pair of 7x50 binoculars on a tripod, I watched the shuttle go by for a minute and a half. I also had a handy talkie in my hand that was tuned to 146.43, the Lockfield repeater in Kings Park, which repeats astronaut audio from the NASA Select satellite channel. So therefore, I heard the astronauts declare main engine cutoff, and I'm optically watching through the binoculars, and I'm seeing the great big triangular aluminum yellow plume coming out of the space shuttle. And after they declared main engine cutoff, I'm seeing that plume for the next couple of seconds. And I saw the plume pop, go into a couple of pops a couple of times. And then the shuttle became much dimmer in the binoculars, but never winked out. The next thing that happens, there's supposed to be a minute and a 40 seconds of delay before they turn on the orbital maneuvering system engine, which burns for a total of 12 minutes. I mean, the mission elapsed time of 12 and a half minutes when they're finally in the right altitude of orbit. And the orbital maneuvering system engine is a smaller pair of engines than the three engines that are called the main engines. And so it looked to me like they turned on the orbital maneuvering engine essentially instantaneously without the minute and 40 seconds of delay while they jettisoned the external tank, because as far as plumes are concerned, it never went out. I saw it continuously until it went over my eastern horizon. It rose over my southern horizon, disappeared over my eastern horizon or east-northeast horizon, and I saw a plume coming out of that vehicle all the way. Various changes in magnitude of the plume, but I saw it. So Mel and I and you and everybody else will be discussing this a little bit later. That was a fun thing to watch. The Langley-Rice program and the terrain, you put in the terrain.